Chapter 11. Exactly 2 weeks after Belisarius arrived at the capital of Kaushambi, the Malwa finally met his price. All things considered, Belisarius was pleased with himself. As treason went, he thought he had driven a hard bargain, especially for a novice. Nandalal thought so too. "You are as bad as a horse trader," chuckled the Malwa official. His Greek was excellent. Only the slightest trace of an accent and the extreme precision of his grammar indicated that he was not a native to the language. He chuckled again. "Are you certain you're really a general?" Belisarius nodded. "I've been a soldier my entire adult life, but I was raised in the countryside, you know. Peasants are natural-born hagglers." Nandalal laughed, and a very open-hearty laugh it was, too. Belisarius was impressed. He thought he had never met a better liar in his entire life than Nandalal, nor one whose inner soul was so far at variance with his outer trappings. Officially, Nandalal bore many titles. He was first one of the Anvaya Prapta Sachivya, the phrase translated approximately as acquirer of the post of minister by hereditary descent. It indicated that Nandalal belonged to that most exclusive of Malwa elites, those who were blood kin of the emperor and were thus entitled to call themselves part of the Malwa dynasty. No man in the Malwa Empire who was not Anvaya Prapta Sachivya could rise to hope to any of the very highest official posts, military or civilian. Second, Nandalal was a mantran, a high counselor, and thus sat on the empire's central advisory body to Emperor Skandagupta, the Mantra Parishad. True, Nandalal was one of the junior members of that council, but the Malwa called Kumaramatya, a cadet minister. But his status was still among the most exalted in all of India. Third, Nandalal occupied the specific post which the Malwa called the Akshapatala Dikrita. The title roughly translated into the innocuous-sounding phrase, the Lord Keeper of State Documents. What he really was a spy. It might be better to say, the spy, or better still, the Grand Spy Master. Nandalal's laugh died away. After a last rueful shake of his head, he asked, "So, General, tell me, what did you think? I'm quite curious, really." "I was only joking, you know, about the horse trader business." Another little hearty chuckle. "Only a general would have demanded a tour of inspection of our military facilities before he gave his allegiance to our cause. In addition, of course, to a fortune." Hearty chuckle. "Another fortune, I should say." Hearty chuckle. "That was quite nicely done, by the way, if you'll permit me saying so." Hearty chuckle. That little casual wave. "Oh, something simple, like that other chest you gave me." Belisarius shrugged. "It seemed the most straightforward thing to do. And I wanted to know, well, let's just say that I'm sick to death of stingy, tight-fisted emperors who expect miracles for a handful of coins. As to your question, what did I think?" Before answering, Belisarius examined the room carefully. He was not looking for eavesdroppers. He hadn't had the slightest doubt they were there. He was simply interested. Nandalal's official quarters, by Malwa standards, were positively austere. And Belisarius had noted earlier that Nandalal had brewed and served the tea they were drinking with his own hands. No servants were allowed in his inner sanctum. Capable hands, thought Belisarius, glancing at them. Like most members of the dynastic clan, Nandalal was heavy-set. But the spymaster's squat form had none of the doughy, soft appearance of most Anvaya Prapta Sachivya. There's quite a bit of muscle there, Belisarius suspected, and he did not doubt that Nandalal's hands were good at other tasks than brewing tea. For all their immaculate, manicured perfection, they were the hands of a strangler, not a scribe. "I was very impressed," he replied, "especially by the scale of the cannon manufacturing and the ammunition works. We are, amassing a tremendous weight of firepower to throw into battle." He fell silent, scratching his chin thoughtfully. "But," queried Nandalal, "you haven't quite given enough thought to logistics," said Belisarius forcefully. There's an old soldier saying, Nandalal, amateurs study tactics, professionals study logistics. The Veda weapons, whatever their origin, and you will please notice that I do not ask, are not truly magical. Even with them, it still took you 2 years to recapture Radhapur. You should have done it much sooner. Nandalal seemed genuinely interested now. Really? Let me ask you, General, how long it would have taken you to reduce Radhapur? 8 months, came the instant reply. Without cannon. With them, 4 months. The Malwa official's eyes widened. So quickly? What did we do wrong? Two things. First, as I said, your logistics are lousy. You substitute mass labor for skill and expertise. You need to develop a professional quartermaster corps instead of... He did not sneer, quite. Instead of piling up tens of thousands of men on top of each other. If you were to study the Radhapur campaign, I'm sure you'd find that most of that absurd pile of provisions simply went to feed the men who amassed it. Belisarius leaned forward in his chair. And that leads me to my second criticism. Your armies are much too slow and, well, I won't say timid exactly. Your soldiers seem courageous enough, especially the Yetai and Rajputs, but they are used timidly. Nandalal's eyes held equal amounts of interest and suspicion. And you would use them better, he asked, if we made you our high commander. Belisarius did not miss the veiled antagonism. Suspicion came as naturally to Nandalal as swimming to a fish. The Roman general dismissed the notion with a curt flip of his hand. Why ask, Nandalal? You have already agreed that I can best serve by returning to Rome. I will encourage Justinian's ambition to reconquer the western Mediterranean and make sure that his armies are tied up there for years. That will clear the way for you to invade Persia without hindrance. And after Persia? Belisarius shrugged. That is a problem for the future. When war finally erupts between Malwa and Rome, I will have to openly change allegiance. When that time comes, you will decide what position in your army to give me. I'm not concerned with the question at the moment. It is still several years away. The suspicion faded from Nandalal's eyes. Abruptly, the Malwa official rose. I will give careful consideration to the points you raise, General. But for the moment, I think we can leave off this discussion. Belisarius rose himself, stretching his limbs, then said with a rueful smile, I don't suppose we're done for the day, by any chance. Nandalal's headshake was as rueful as Belisarius's smile. I'm afraid not. It's still early in the afternoon, General. There are at least 4 officials who have insisted on meeting you today. And then, this evening, we have an important social visit to make. Belisarius cocked his eyebrow. Nandalal's shrug was an exquisite display of exasperation, resignation, carefully suppressed irritation. The accompanying smile exuded a sense of comradeship and travail. The great Lady Holi, you have heard of her, perhaps? Belisarius shook his head. Ah, well, she is the Emperor's favorite aunt. Quite a formidable woman, despite her age. For days now she has been demanding to meet you. She's fascinated, it seems, by all the tales concerning this mysterious foreign general. Nandalal took Belisarius by the elbow and began ushering him toward the door. His smile broadened. Her main interest, I suspect, stems from your reputed appearance. She is immensely fond of the company of young, handsome men. Seeing Belisarius's slight start, Nandalal laughed. Have no fear, General. The woman is almost 70 years old, and she is quite the ascetic, actually. I assure you, she just likes to look. Nandalal opened the door, with his own hands, as always. No servants were allowed in those quarters. He followed Belisarius into the corridor beyond. After locking the door, it was the only door in the palace, so far as Belisarius had seen, which had a lock, Nandalal led the way down the wide hall. Anyway, she has been pestering the Emperor for days. Finally, he tired of it. So this morning, just before your arrival, he instructed me to take you to Great Lady Holi this evening after we were finished. Belisarius sighed. Nandalal grimaced. I understand. General, but please, be of good cheer. We will not be there long, I assure you. A few minutes to pay our respects, a casual chat, no more. Belisarius squared his shoulders with resignation. As you wish, Nandalal. She's in the palace? Nandalal made another rueful headshake. Alas, I fear not. She dislikes the palace. She claims it is too noisy and crowded, so she makes her dwelling on a barge moored in the river. Hearty chuckle. It's not as bad as all that. You wouldn't want to miss Great Lady Holly's barge before you leave. It's quite a marvel, really it is. The most splendiferous barge in all creation. I can't wait, muttered Belisarius. They were now passing by the main entrance to the Grand Palace. The general stopped Nandalal with a hand on his arm. Give me a moment, if you would, to notify my cataphracts of our plans. There's no need for them to stand outside in that hot sun for the rest of the day. Nandalal nodded graciously. Belisarius strode through the palace doors into the courtyard beyond. As always, the three cataphracts were waiting just outside the main entrance to the Grand Palace. Their horses and that of Belisarius were tethered nearby. Since the first day of their arrival in Kaushambi, when Belisarius had begun his protracted negotiations with the Mantri Parishad, he had ordered the cataphracts to remain outside. To have taken them with him whenever he went into the palace would have indicated a certain skittishness which would be quite inappropriate for a man cheerfully planning treason. And besides, the cataphracts would have inevitably cast a pall on his negotiations. Many of the Anvia Prapta Satchavya, who inhabited the palace, had been present in the pavilion when the Lord of Ranipur and his family were executed, and those who weren't had heard the tale. It would have been amusing, of course, to watch the highest of Malwa cringe in the presence of Valentinian. Amusing, but counterproductive. Quickly, Belisarius sketched the situation and told his cataphracts to go back to their residence. Valentinian put up a bit of an argument, but not much. More in the nature of a formality than anything else. They were supposed to be bodyguards, after all, but Belisarius insisted, and his men were happy enough to climb on their horses and return to the comfort and shade of their luxurious quarters. "That's all of it, Your Majesty," said Holker. He tied the drawstring of the bag tightly and nestled it into a pocket of silk cloth in the small chest. Then he closed the lid of the chest and stood up. For a moment he examined his handiwork admiringly, and then scanned the rest of the room. Since arriving in Kaushambi, the Romans and Ethiopians had been quartered in a mansion located in the imperial district of the capital. The imperial district stretched along the south bank of the Jumana, just west of that river's junction with the mighty Ganges. The emperor's grand palace anchored the eastern end of the district. The mansion lay toward the western end, not far from the flotilla of luxurious barges which served the Malwa elite as temporary residences during the summer. The waters of the Jumna, in which that fleet was anchored, helped assuage the heat. Stretching in a great arc just south of the imperial district was the heart of the Malwa weapons and munitions project, a great complex of cannon, rocket, and gunpowder manufactories. The odors wafting from that complex were often obnoxious, but the Malwa elite tolerated the discomfort for the sake of security. The Veda weapons were the core of their power, and they kept them close at hand. The mansion in which the foreigners had been lodged belonged to one of Skandagupta's innumerable second cousins, absent on imperial assignment in Bihar. The building was almost a small palace. There had been more than enough rooms to quarter the entire Kushan escort within its walls, in addition to the foreign envoys themselves. And best of all, for Shakuntala and Aeon, they had finally been able to spend a few nights alone. Shakuntala, at least, had spent the nights alone in her bed. Dadaji glanced over at Tarabai, sitting on a cushion in the corner of Shakuntala's huge bedchamber. He restrained a smile. The Maratha woman had been almost inseparable from Aeon since their arrival. Today, in fact, was the first day she had resumed her duties as an imperial lady-in-waiting, if at least the activity of the day could be called the duty of a chambermaid. Holker rather doubted it. Rarely, probably never, had an imperial lady-in-waiting spent an entire day helping her empress count a fortune. Holker's eyes returned to the chest whose lid he had just closed. That chest was only one of many small chests which were strewn about Shakuntala's quarters. Those chests were much smaller than the chest which stood in the center of the room. That chest, that huge chest, dazzling in its intricate carvings and adorned with gold and rubies, the colors of the Mawa dynasty, was now completely empty. Shakuntala shook her head. She almost seemed in a daze. When she spoke, her voice was half filled with awe. "I can't believe it," she whispered. "There was as much in that chest as... Dadaji smiled. "As the yearly income of a prince. The rich prince." The scribe stroked his jaw. "Still, it's not really that much for an imperial war chest." Shakuntala was still shaking her head. "How will I ever repay Belisarius?" she mused. Dadaji's smile broadened.
"Have no fear, your majesty.
The general does not expect to be repaid with coin, only with the blows you will deliver unto Malwa. Blows which this treasure will help to finance. How did he put it? An empress without money is a political and military cripple. A crippled ally will not be much use to Rome." Shakuntala left off shaking her head. After taking a deep breath, she sat up straight. "He's right, of course. But how many men do you know would turn over such a fortune to a stranger? And it wasn't just the last Mawa bribe, either."
"How many men?" asked Holker. "Very few, your majesty. Very, very few."
The slave laughed aloud.
"And I know of only one who would do so with such glee."
Shakuntala grinned herself, remembering Belisarius's cheerful words the previous evening, when he presented her with the chest which Nanda Lal had just bestowed on him, and half the contents of the first, the one Skandagupta gave him at Ranipur. "I like to think of it as poetic justice," the general had said, smiling crookedly. "Let the Mawa bribes finance Andhra's rebellion." It had taken the entire day for Shakuntala, the Maratha women, and Holkar to repackage the coins and gems into smaller units which could be more easily transported. Most of the treasure was packed away in the many small chests, but some of it had been placed in purses which Shakuntala had distributed to all the members of her party. The Maratha women, poor in their origins, had been absolutely stunned by her act. Each of them now carried on her person more money than their entire extended families had earned in generations of toil. Holker glanced shrewdly at the four young women sitting in the corner. They had recovered from the shock, he thought, but if there had been any lingering doubt or hesitation in their allegiance to Shakuntala, it had now vanished. The trust of their empress had welded them to her completely. When Holker's eyes returned to Shakuntala, he immediately understood the question in her face.
"There is no need, your majesty," he said, shaking his head. "My allegiance is still to Belisarius, even though you are my sovereign. If he wishes me to have money, he will give it to me. I cannot take it from another. And besides," he gestured mockingly at his loincloth, "where would I hide it?"
Shakuntala began to reply, but was interrupted by a knock on the door.
Tarabai opened the door.
Valentinian stepped into the room, accompanied by Aeon. They walked over to Shakuntala.
"We may as well plan for an early supper," said Aeon.
The prince gestured at Valentinian.
"The cataphracts just arrived from the palace. Belisarius dismissed them for the rest of the day. It seems he won't be returning until late this evening. He has some social event he must attend."
The cataphract scowled.
"These imperial Malwa are even worse than Greek nobility when it comes to hobnobbing with celebrities. Bad enough he's got to waste hours with every third-rate bureaucrat at the palace. Now they're insisting he has to meet with old women."
Shakuntala frowned. "Old women? In the palace?" Valentinian shook his head.
"No, worse. They're dragging him off to some barge in the river to meet with one of the emperor's elderly relatives. Great aunt, I think."
Shakuntala grew still, utterly still.
"What is her name?" she hissed.
Valentinian squinted at her, startled by her tone of voice.
"She's called the Great Lady Holy. Why?"
Shakuntala shot to her feet.
"She is a witch, a sorceress."
Valentinian and Aeon gaped at her. Shakuntala stamped her foot angrily.
"It's true, you fools."
With an effort, the girl restrained herself.
These were the type of men she knew for whom any hint of hysterics would be counterproductive.
Believe me, Valentinian, Aeon.
Her voice was low and calm, but deadly serious. My father spoke of her several times to me. His spies did not know much. It was dangerous to go near her. But they did learn enough to know that she is very powerful among the Malwa. Do not let her age deceive you. She is a witch. Valentinian was the first to recover.
I'll get the others, he said, spinning around to the door.
Less than a minute later, he was back, followed by all the members of the Roman and Axumite missions. He brought Kungus also. Aeon took charge. We have an unexpected situation which we need to assess. Quickly, the prince sketched the situation. Then to Kungus. Bring Kanishka and Kujalo and your other two troop leaders. Kungus disappeared. Aeon waved everyone else into the room. All of you, come in and sit. In the short seconds that it took for everyone to take a seat, most of them on the floor, Kungus returned with his four chief subordinates in tow. The five Kushans entered the room but did not bother to sit. Aeon began at once.
You've all heard... He hesitated, casting a glance at Kungus.
I've told them, grunted the Kushan commander.
You've all heard about the situation, continued Aeon. It may be a false alarm, but there's enough reason to think otherwise.
He took a breath.
As you know, we hoped to make our exit from India quietly. Just a peaceful diplomatic mission heading back for home. But Belisarius always warned us that things could go wrong. That's why he insisted on obtaining those horses and the elephants.
Another breath. A deep breath.
Well, that time may be here. We have to assume that it is.
He scanned the room. Everyone's face was grim but not distraught, except possibly for Menander. The young cataphract's face was pale from fear. Not fear for himself, but for his general.
Do you have a plan?
Asked Anastasius. Aeon shrugged. Belisarius discussed some possible alternatives. You heard them yourself. But none of those alternatives really apply, since Belisarius himself may not be able to join us. So we'll have to improvise. He stared at Shakuntala. The first thing is to make sure she gets out safely. Kungus, you and your men will escort the Empress and her women.
The Kushans nodded.
Aeon glanced around the room, examining the treasure chests.
Good. You're already prepared.
Anastasius interrupted.
They'll have to take the Kushan girls, too. If the general's in a trap, we'll need to make one hell of a diversion. We won't be able to do it with the girls in tow.
That's not a problem, stated Kungus. We can fit them in as camp followers. No one will think it odd.
Aeon nodded his head. All right. The rest of us, except Dadaji, will be the lure. Dadaji, you'll have to go with the Empress.
Aeon drove down Holker's protest.
You are not thinking, man. Forget your obligation to Belisarius and remember your obligation to his purpose. The only way to get Shakuntala out of here is by subterfuge. A young noblewoman would never travel through India unaccompanied. Someone has to pose as her husband. It can't be one of us. Only Valentinian looks enough like an Indian, and his accent is terrible. You're the only one who could pull it off.
Holker opened his mouth, snapped it shut. Then, grudgingly, nodded. He even recaptured his sense of humor.
With your permission, Your Majesty.
Shakuntala nodded imperiously, but there was just a little trace of a smile on her lips.
I'll need a change of clothes, murmured Holker. A loincloth simply won't do.
He chuckled.
How fortunate that Belisarius made me buy those clothes. Is he a fortune teller, do you think?
Valentinian shook his head.
No, but he does like to plan for all eventualities, cover all the angles.
Such mechanistic nonsense, said Usanas cheerfully.
The truth is quite otherwise. Belisarius is a witch himself.
Fortunately, he is our witch.
Valentinian ignored the quip.
Anything else? He demanded.
Yes, said Kungus. You'll need a guide. He pointed to Kujalo. Kujalo is very familiar with the Deccan, and his Marathi is fluent. Three or four other of my men are also.
Take all of them with you. You will need the added manpower anyway. Yours will be the bloody road.
Kujalo grinned. Aeon frowned.
We can't have any hint that Kushans are involved, he protested. That could jeopardize the Empress. Kungus waved the protest aside.
They can disguise themselves as Yetai. Kujalo does an excellent imitation.
Immediately, Kujalo stooped, thrust out his lower jaw, slumped his shoulders, allowed a vacant look to enter his gaze, grunted animal noises. A little laugh swept the room. There was no time for hesitation. Aeon nodded, then said,
Fine. That's it, then. Let's... No.
The imperial tone froze everyone in the room. Aeon began to glare at Shakuntala.
We've already...
No. Valentinian tried.
Your Majesty, our plans...
No. Before anyone else could speak, Shakuntala said forcefully,
You are not thinking clearly. None of you.
Aeon.
The general... You are especially not thinking like the general.
Valentinian, hotly.
Of course we're thinking of him. But there's nothing...
The cataphract stopped abruptly. Shakuntala's actual words penetrated. Her piercing black eyes, fixed upon him, held Valentinian pinned.
Yes, she said. You are not thinking like Belisarius. If he were faced with a sudden change in his situation, he would alter the situation, add a new angle.
What angle? Demanded Aeon. Shakuntala grinned.
We need another diversion. A great one.
Something which can serve to signal all of us, we will be separated, remember, that the escape is on. A diversion so great it will not only help cover our own escape, but make it possible, maybe, for Belisarius himself to escape. I'm for it, announced Menander, with a shrug.
Whatever it is.
Shakuntala told him what it was. When she finished, the room erupted with protests from everyone except Menander. I'm for it, repeated the young cataphract stubbornly.
Fool girl is mad, muttered Usanas. I say it again, royalty's stupid by nature.
Shakuntala overrode all protests with the simplest of arguments.
I command.
Protest, protest, protest.
I command.
Protest, protest, protest.
I command.
On the way out, Kanishka complained bitterly to his commander. How are we supposed to be an imperial bodyguard if the damned empress herself... Kungus looked at him. As always, his face showed nothing, but there might have been just a trace of humor in his words.
You could always go back to work for Venon de Catra. He never took any personal risks.
Kanishka shut up. As he and Nanda Lal walked out of the palace that evening, Belisarius found that a palanquin had already been brought up to convey them to the great Lady Holy's barge. The palanquin was festooned with the red and gold pennants of the dynasty. The pennants alone guaranteed that all would give way to the palanquin wherever it went in the teeming capital. But they were hardly necessary. The 40 Yetai bodyguards who rode before the palanquin would cheerfully trample anyone so foolish as to get in the way. And the palanquin itself, toted by no less than 12 slaves, looked solid and heavy enough to crush an elephant. Quite an entourage, he murmured. Does she really insist on so many bodyguards? Nanda Lal shook his head. As it happens, the great lady is petrified by armed strangers anywhere in the vicinity of her barge. She maintains her own special security force. She doesn't even trust the imperial bodyguard. The spymaster pointed to the red and gold uniformed Yetai. Only 4 of these men will be allowed to remain after we arrive. The journey to the barge was quite brief. The wharves where the Malwa Empire's highest nobility maintained their pleasure barges were less than 0.5 mile from the Grand Palace. Once they climbed out of the palanquin, Belisarius found himself almost goggling at the great Lady Holy's barge. As Nanda Lal had said, it was truly splendid. In its basic size and shape, the barge was no different from that of all the Malwa luxury barges. About 90 feet long and 30 feet wide, the barges had a rounded and big-bellied shape. The oddest thing, to the Romans' eyes, were the double sterns, looking not unlike the sterns of 2 ships joined. Each stern sported a huge figurehead in the form of an animal's head, lions in the case of Great Lady Holy's barge. The splendor was in the trimmings. Everywhere the red and gold colors of the dynasty. The huge lion's head figurines were covered with beaten gold.
All the oarlocks were trimmed with gold. Rubies inlaid into gold plaques formed the edging of the guardrails, and on and on and on. It was amazing the boat didn't sink from the sheer weight of its decoration. Belisarius followed Nanda Lal up the ramp which connected the barge to the wharf. The ramp debouched in a covered walkway which encircled the main cabins. Once aboard the vessel, Nanda Lal entered through a door directly opposite the ramp. A moment later, Belisarius found himself in the plush interior of the barge. Age's thought came like a thunderclap. Danger. Belisarius almost stumbled. Why? Link is here. I can sense it. The facets shivered with agitation, but the general simply smiled. At last, my enemy.